as nurse and school teacher, respectively, farther. A not insubstantial amount of my childhood was spent piling firewood into massive, neat, and sturdy stacks, which carried with it a degree of collaborative importance to the family's well-being and the resultant flush of satisfaction. It was like if I was in charge of filling the 31-gallon gas tank on the Suburban for a road trip, but I could only accomplish it 1 ounce at a time with a spoon. As Dad then drove us all on our way in this hypothetical, and we passed a sign that read, "Welcome to Michigan," I would look out the window and nod to myself, thinking, "We did this." Similarly, thanks to several recent frigid nights spent at Racy Gill, I also had a personal stake in this firewood James and I were processing. Back in the dead of winter, I had relied heavily upon the previous year's firewood batch to keep me toasty through the night, out in the guest apartment attached to their sheep barn. That sounds rustic and a bit rough, and frankly, I wish it were more so, to up the bucolic idyll factor even higher. Guests may throw down a bedroll amongst the hay bales, just be sure to stay out of reach of any munching Herdwicks come morning. This labor I was performing with James carried a solid weight. We weren't two guys working hard for a cash wage. We were creating affection, via warmth, for all who would benefit from the fires this wood would fuel. Our good labor would directly propagate life, with no middleman or woman. We two have shared a good deal of discourse about the lessons handed down to us from our fathers concerning good labor, good work. In a rural setting, there's no end to the good one can do with some know-how, a few tools, and some productive labor, or graft, across the pond, which hopefully means some extra hands. Some of it will lead directly to income for the farmer family, but some of it will earn a different kind of recompense, lucre that can only be cashed in the form of birdsong, honeycomb, fresh leeks, or a pint jar of lilacs, a largemouth bass, a stack of cured white oak planks. In other words, the physical and spiritual health of our bodies and also of our environs can pay out great dividends indeed, without sending anybody a check. This stripe of labor is beautiful in the eyes of the great economy, but it is not the labor being referred to in our small money economy when the bankers talk about the, quote, labor class. The corporate definition of labor paints a more dehumanizing picture that is concerned with the health of the laborer and their workplace only insofar as they affect the bottom line. To the corporation, labor is a binary line item in a profit report that demands just as little or as much dignity as other items, like gasoline, post-it notes, and mayonnaise. This is a substantial problem. How can we expect anyone to pay attention to our relationship with labor upon the land when our military-industrial complex won't even value the human being to start with? Aldo Leopold wrote, "Civilization has so cluttered this elemental man-earth relationship with gadgets and middlemen that awareness of it is growing dim. We fancy that industry supports us, forgetting what supports industry. The vast majority of our population is never required to think about how we're doing as stewards of the land that supports all of us, a blissful ignorance which is turning out to be a dearly purchased luxury. Think about all the necessities in our lives that we purchase from corporations: electricity, steaks, gas heat, sausages, most of our groceries, ribs, pharmaceuticals, bacon, clothing, pork chops, vehicles, ground beef, and so forth. It's easier to think of what items we don't get from corporations, which brings to mind the local farmer's market, my raw wood materials for Offerman Wood Shop, some hand tools, and little else. When we give our money to corporations, in most of our situations, especially for urban and suburban dwellers, We are also handing them our agency, implying a tacit agreement that they will be producing and sending us our electricity/breakfast cereal/diapers in a way that is respectful of other humans but also the environment. The resources required and the mode of transport or delivery, the packaging involved, and so on, comprise a long list of responsibilities that we are trusting our corporations to honor. I doubt that anyone listening to this would be so naive as to think that the majority of these companies are doing a good job with those responsibilities, because in many cases they don't have to do a good job. The ever-strengthening chokehold that corporations and their lobbyists have on our regulatory agencies generally works in favor of the polluter, and you know how we humans behave. If nobody tells us we have to clean up our rooms or do the dishes? Well, according to the American money economy, not to mention the last Republican president, you're a sucker if you follow a rule nobody is making you obey. Take, for example, the case of some factory hog facilities in Illinois that were found guilty in recent years of egregious local water pollution, in which streams were so drowned and blackened by sewage overflow that all life was snuffed out. That means hundreds of thousands of fish and mussels, and of course the teeming microbial life that supports all the rest, in hundreds of miles of waterways. The culprits were a handful of facilities generally referred to as hog confinements. I mean, do we need any more persuasion than that term alone as to the morality of this practice? Raising animals for meat in cold industrial buildings known as confinements is pretty hard to defend with a straight face, but rest assured, these, quote, farmers do. Most of Illinois' CAFOs, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations per the state's moniker, house at least 5,000 head of hogs at a given time, in cages, basically, in gigantic sheds. In terms of the balance of nature, of the great economy, it's not difficult to step back and see the central problem. When we grow animals like we're pumping out Twinkies in a factory, those teeming herds produce way too much digestive waste for the comparatively tiny acreage they inhabit. CAFOs are literally and extremely full of shit. This is obviously disgusting, but also dangerous from a hygienic point of view. These confinements are but one example of the proliferation of monocultures, which have taken over American agriculture. Whether it's with fowl, fish, beast, or grain, when we exclude any and all variety from our farming produce, we supply an open invitation to Mother Nature to discipline us by sending any number of plagues to wipe out the harvest: viral enemies, insects, weather-based disasters like drought or flood, you name it. The way we relegate ourselves to this very vulnerable position is by trying to avoid as much labor as possible. We do everything we can to increase a farm's output far beyond a scale that is manageable to humans or the nature we inhabit. By moving the miracle of life from out of doors inside to highly engineered meat factories. The articles I read about these criminally shitty pig confinements in Illinois boasted that it was producers like these that accounted for Illinois being the fourth largest pork-producing state in the nation, as though quantity is what you're shooting for when it comes to producing food. Because money. When I first started Offerman Woodshop 20 years ago, my business manager kept haranguing me to choose one of my furniture pieces to put into production, ideally a piece he could get placed in the Sky Mall magazine, which was a thing that used to exist on commercial airplanes, kids, because otherwise all I was getting out of the shop was the small trickle of profit that came with each commission and a veritable river of satisfaction. I patiently explained to him time and time again that mass-producing a wooden item, say a waste paper basket, would be perfectly counterintuitive to the purpose of the shop. The personal labor involved in the crafting of a table or chair or canoe was the whole handmade point. When Aldo Leopold assumed his new position at the University of Wisconsin at Madison in 1933, he was also placed in charge of the school's arboretum, where he was able to perpetuate the obsession that had held him in its sway since he was a child on the shores of the Mississippi. Lovingly observing and cataloging the trees, plants, birds, and animals in a given watershed. Besides simply maintaining a healthy census, this practice also helped him to determine how these non-human neighbors were faring in the wake of the local weather and on the receiving end of the activities of the men and women dwelling amongst them. This discipline spellbound his attention so fully that he sought to continue the practice on his own time with the help of his formidable bride, Estella, and their five erudite children on a worn-out Sauk County farm that they purchased in 1935. The family fixed up an old shack on the property that had once housed chickens and made of it their rustic paradise, to which they escaped whenever possible. With the help of the kids and countless collaborators and volunteers over the years, the Leopold platoon planted thousands upon thousands of native wildflowers, shrubs, and grasses that had previously been eradicated from the area in favor of more profitable plants and methods. The prairies and forests of their farm began to hum with a renewed variety of insect and bird life, and the long job of replenishing the once healthy topsoil that had been despoiled and eroded was begun. As a land steward, Leopold had no equal, as is well chronicled in his masterwork, A Sand County Almanac. The reason for this was that he made stewardship itself his objective. This flew in direct contrast to American agribusiness, which then, and even exponentially more so now, held itself apart from nature. It attempted, and yet still attempts, to solve every man-made problem with another man-made problem. It somehow thought that it could prosper by violently overpowering nature instead of working in concert with her. Wendell Berry wrote, "The clear tendency of industrial agriculture has been to destroy any living thing that cannot be sold." And the Leopolds were devoted to the opposite extreme, armed with Aldo's cautionary knowledge of the mountain without the wolf and the spent, lifeless condition of their farm soil when they had first arrived. I had no idea that I would be writing this chapter when Mr. Rebanks chased me away from my tea and biscuits back out into the Racy Gill Meadow. We were planting oak saplings all over the rolling hills, strategically located to provide strips of woodland that related to the waterways or becks. We had a system down between the two of us, a quick spade, insert tiny root ball end of 2-foot spindly trunk, install biodegradable green protective sleeve to keep nibbling sheep and deer from hurting our feelings, tramp the dirt down, repeat. James had me running back and forth to the pile of saplings and green tubes, and the faster I would go, the farther ahead of me he would stay. Typically American, I wondered why we were working so fast when we might slow down a tad and take in this beautiful weather and scenery. The answer was simply that the more we got done, the healthier the farm became. I was a tourist looking for a pleasant lollygag, but James and his family were not messing around. They loved this land and they loved their place upon it or even within it. And the more they hustled, the more they were repaid with treasures galore. Tadpoles, nesting birds that had been absent for decades, grasses and wild leaves that had once been declared garbage but were now redeemed. These activities, remarkably like the Wisconsin-based efforts of the Leopold family 85 years earlier, are how the Rebanks team fill in gaps between other farming responsibilities. I was but one of dozens of volunteers across the year, and we planted not only trees, but myriad scattered wildflowers and grasses as well, again trying to bring the pastures back to the ancient, robust fecundity they once knew, before us dummies showed up to improve the land. The parallels between the Leopolds and the Rebankses don't end there either. Aldo Leopold's kids would later talk about how they craved their visits to the shack, where they vowed to bring only the items that were absolutely necessary: a guitar, a gun, a picnic basket, and a dog. Sure sounds like a good time to me. I've also seen footage in which the family is employing carpenter's tools to repair and expand their humble shed, nearly doubling the square footage. Leopold's daughter Luna remarked years later that their time there was a study in, quote, how one can find absolute happiness with the least amount of stuff. This phrase absolutely lit me up because it's exactly what I have always said about my own family's annual fishing trip to a cabin in Minnesota. I guess I should say almost exactly, because my own list of stuff usually adds the words beer, grill, and pinochle deck as well. Speaking of card games, one of the most delightful evenings for me at the Rebanks house was attempting to teach James and his two daughters how to play Liverpool Rummy, which is the traditional barn burner of the Offerman household. It's great fun, but has several rules, and each hand adds another card and grows progressively harder. So after they put up with me for a few hands, we quit and turned to their two traditional household pastimes, a dance competition and a form of charades. The dancing incorporated a game on the Wii console that was played by mimicking the animated dancers on the telly whilst holding a game controller in the right hand. The whole family were very enthusiastic dancers whose moves exhibited talent and panache. So one was required to dive right in and give it a proper go if one hoped at all to succeed. No inhibitions allowed. Fortunately, making a fool of myself is what I do for a living. In fact, I was classically trained to excel at opportunities just like this one, so I was able to relish my go and show those shepherds just how magnificently a clown can fall upon his face. These examples of amusements are imperative, I think, to the Leopold sensibility. Firstly, they require a minimum of consumer goods. Yes, the Wii game console and television violate that notion, but they were not necessary. They were merely embellishments to what would have been a perfectly achievable good time without them. Kick-ass dance moves are better ideally with music, but as music is easily had in this modern era, shaking one's booty is a human art form that can be employed at any time, almost anywhere. Second, the pastimes required the participant to check their ego at the door. The group presented no danger of judgment or ridicule, but only a collective support, a tacit agreement that delight and mirth were the pursuits at hand. Third, it goes almost without saying, but all three of the discussed arenas, the Leopold's shack, my family's fishing cabin, and the Rebanks' house, were also readily supplied with books. Everybody was reading something at some point, and sometimes writing, and also drawing and painting. All of which is to remind myself, and you, should you care to hear it, that life can be incredibly rich and rewarding without involving modern distractions and consumer goods. I might even argue that the well-curated lifestyle of the Luddite is more edifying because it lacks the disappointment of empty accomplishments. A simple example would be the time I spent 2 solid weeks defeating a video game versus when I occupied a couple of weeks building a coffee table from a gorgeous slab of California Claro walnut. Both activities produced plenty of dopamine in my body, causing me to feel mounting pleasure as I completed more and more levels of the ultimate task, But as you might have guessed, when the video game was finished and I had won the ultimate victory therein, vanquishing all of the bosses on every level, I suffered an immediate emotional crash. The utter meaninglessness of my achievement washed over me like a brisk, salty Hebridean wave. Of course, when the table was finished, I sat next to it and set my beer upon it, and felt the substantial comfort that accompanies making something of good use out of raw materials. To assiduously simplify the matter, as is my wont, I firmly believe that Mother Nature would vastly prefer us to be making tables and singing songs rather than playing video games. In part 3 of this book, we'll similarly compare the exploration of a trail on foot with traversing it under the power of a gas engine. What I am talking about here is the importance of the right kind of labor, what Wendell Berry and my dad call good work. Some of what I have just described falls into the trite category of labors of love, but I disregard that phrase in this context because I think that, to an extent, the Leopolds and the Rebankses, and sometimes the Offermans, have learned that if you play your cards right, then damn near all of your efforts come from a place of affection. We must understand that we are not passive passengers on this mothership Earth, but instead we must participate in the journey, whether that means grabbing an oar and helping to row, or feeding the crew, or holystoning the decks. Only then will we be able to help steer this venerable vessel away from the shopping mall /Amazon.com and toward the woods and the meadow and the beck. What Aldo Leopold and all of the clear-eyed agrarians who came after him want us to see, I think, more than anything else, is that the labor and attention of a human have very specific limits of scale. This means that we need many more good stewards of the land responsible for smaller parcels, so that our society's much diluted attention can be brought back up to the full strength that farm families like the Rebankses pay to her. We have tried focusing solely upon the quantity of dollars that might be wrung out of a given piece of territory, and discovered it to be an empty and destructive task, excepting that a very few people make some money, and that only temporarily. Having recognized the failure in that pursuit, on behalf of the people, the animal life, the plant life, the soil, air, and water, I guess put simply, all of creation, let us be discerning and far-seeing. Let's tax the few who have amassed billions of dollars from the exploitation of the great economy and apply that communal wealth to the mending of our errant industrial methods. Chapter 14. The Land Ethic. August 28, 2019 found me back at the Rebanks farm once more. Since I had last seen the gang, the traveling circus of my work had taken me home to Los Angeles, then touring as a braying humorist all over America, Australia, and New Zealand, and now back to the vibrant green of England's Lake District and Scotland to the north. I had just visited the wonderfully uneventful Scottish island of Islay for a few days to film a new commercial campaign for Lagavulin single malt Scotch whiskey in and around its picturesque distillery on the island. I had then filmed a few more days of commercials in Glasgow, including one that featured me on horseback, dressed as the famous anti-Semite Mel Gibson when he was dressed as the famous anti-English William Wallace from Braveheart, elocuting in a passionate Scottish brogue that I fear was possibly even worse than Gibson's accent in the film, but boy howdy was I having fun. The morning before shooting the Braveheart scene found me curled up in the fetal position, lying naked in the tall wet grass of a Glasgow park. Have we talked about midges? While there were times in the past that would have perhaps seen me behave thusly due to some degree of inebriation, this time I'm pleased to say that it was just another commercial scene, this one set at the dawn of time, and thankfully MOS. That's fancy film talk, meaning mit out Scottish. Between the chilly morning dew and the horseback hollering, a light cold had taken root in my nose and throat, so by the next night I had fully lost my voice. Unfortunately, I was also scheduled to perform my comedy show that night, including 7 songs, for a sold-out house of 2,500 souls at Glasgow's O2 Academy Theatre. James and Helen Rebanks came to the show, and, thanks to copious amounts of tea, honey, lemon, and powerful lozenges, plus a wee dram of scotch or two, I managed to croak out the 90 minutes of material intelligibly enough that many patrons stayed for the whole show. Well, maybe not many, but several, anyway, and the Rebankses were among the tolerators because they have very good manners. I'm sincerely grateful that I was able to successfully communicate my material and get a few laughs, because so far in our relationship, the two of them had exclusively been brandishing heroics hither and yon and repeatedly knocking me on my ass with their stamina and competence as I merely skittered after them, giggling and trying to catch my breath. How old is this stone shed? What is this fluffy puff of heaven? A Yorkshire pudding? Okay, it's like a popover. I burst into tears. Floss, the sheepdog, is kissing me. How can you two possibly get this much done? And so forth. And although they had been lightly familiar with some of my acting work before we met, this performance was the first time since I had presumed myself a new member of their family that I could show them what my deal was. I said, "Oh, you're raising 4 kids and 250 sheep and some cows and a couple ponies and many chickens, and stewarding your land as best you can with an eye toward her continued health for yourselves, but also for generations to come, all whilst penning best-selling award-winning books? That's all you have to show for your efforts? Well, sorry to shame you right out of the gate, but I wrote this lyric, so some folks live a fancy life in homes of glass and steel. Some find satisfaction in a yurt. Some believe monogamy is the only love that's real. Some are less persnickety where they squirt." Thank you, listener. I can hear the slow, heartfelt clap of approbation you are augustly performing in appreciation. I needed my new mom and dad to understand firsthand that I also had a contribution to make to the overall advancement of our species. Was my AB rhyme scheme remotely commensurate with the agricultural output of their grassy holdings? Only you, the listener, can be the judge of that. But before you reckon the final tally, please give me another quick once-over to be sure you didn't miss any of my subtler puns. And don't forget, I cultivate a terrific mustache. Please clap. As luck would have it, they very much agreed with the tone and point of view of my show, and I was most gratified to hear about it over breakfast the next morning because I had fallen for them hard. And it's common knowledge in showbiz that when your new squeeze comes to your show and you're not good, or they are somehow inexplicably fans of Brett Kavanaugh, they quickly become your former squeeze. We had gotten in quite late post-show after driving 90 minutes home to Racy Gill and slept in till a luxurious 6:30 the next morning. Once my head shrank back down to its normal extra-large size after being swollen by their praise, James and Helen proceeded to regale me with tales of a nighttime event on the farm that I had just missed a few nights earlier, called Bats and Brownies. A nifty naturalist duo, Heather and Kane, called Wild Intrigue, out of Northumberland, came out to the farm after dark and gave a talk about the several local bat species to an appreciative audience of visitors. They discussed how the bats live, what with their flying and locating their insect prey using sonar and such, as the attendees munched on Helen's scrumptious baked goods. That sounded well worth the price of admission already, but then they handed out special bat-detecting headphones that allowed one to comprehend the usually hypersonic squeaks and clicks that the bats use to locate their prey. The healthy pastures at Racy Gill attracted a smorgasbord of insects, which in turn attracted a diverse array of bat types, so the attendees basically got to experience the Glastonbury Music Festival of bat jams out in the meadow. I was sore to have missed this event, but evidently I was blessed with the luck of the humorist, which is a thing I just now made up, because Wild Intrigue was coming back in a couple days to do another cool nature powwow, this one entitled Moths and Muffins. I had to run around and do a couple of comedy performances in Manchester and Leeds, but both cities were near enough that I was able to get back to the farm for life-giving injections of both sleep and sheep. And more importantly, that meant I was present on the morning of moths. The naturalists had set out light traps the previous evening, which were basically tented buckets that attracted a considerable collection of moths at night, using as bait only a small illuminated light. Getting any group of curious people together to satisfy a hunger for learning is fortifying to begin with. But then you throw in some homemade muffins, thanks to Helen and often one of the kids, and some tea or coffee, and it becomes about as ideal a Saturday morning as this moth fan can imagine. Kane and Heather gingerly removed the moths from the enclosure one at a time and placed them in small clear containers so that they could be passed around and handled without doing any damage to the moths themselves. What our investigation uncovered may surprise you. Moths, as majority members of the order Lepidoptera, are at a severe aesthetic disadvantage when held in comparison to their sunnier cousins, the butterflies, or so I thought. I mean, if this were butterflies and beignets, bagels, or burritos, I'm immediately envisioning a much larger turnout on the strength of both the beloved butterfly and its delicious accompaniments. But holy Promethea, were we in for a surprise. The wide range of sizes, shapes, and colorations of this batch of moths produced a hilarious orchestration of oohs, ahs, and, well, I'll be jiggereds, as we held each precious specimen up to the light. Even just a sampling of their names, like Burnished Brass, Dingy Skipper, Elephant Hawk Moth, Painted Lady, Peach Blossom, and Garden Tiger, will no doubt illuminate visions of unexpected wonder in your mind's eye. Each miniature glider had a set of wings emblazoned with a work of art that bore closer and closer degrees of inspection. Heather and Kane spoke knowledgeably about the moths and their importance to the ecosystem of the farm, and they answered our many questions with patience and smarts. Once we had exhausted our collective curiosity, the moths were freed, unharmed, into the woods. The 20 or so paying guests said their thanks and went on their merry, more educated than when they arrived way, and I showered the Rebankses and the Wild Intriguers with praise, delighted like a kid who had just been given his first balloon. Being the sort of clown I am, I immediately began pitching further sessions to the gang. You know, otters and omelets, crows and croissants, and so forth. I can't tell you how much joy it brought me months later when they announced a new mini-expedition based upon one of my silly pitches, and I only hope that I can get there in time to experience frogs and flapjacks. In any case, my lawyers are in talks with the family to be sure I'm properly compensated for my intellectual property. Proper compensation, in truth, for people who say things like proper compensation, would closely resemble a swift kick in the ass. Come spring, according to James's Twitter feed, the frogs arrived in full force, and not by chance. For some years now, James had been undertaking the project of rewilding his acreage, or striving to return it to an older way of farming that walked more comfortably hand in hand with nature. One prime example of his efforts was the rewiggling of that aforementioned stream in the valley bottom that had been straightened into more of a canal a few generations back, with an eye toward more efficient drainage and improved bottomlands. Mother Nature had already spent nigh on an eternity laying out the day-to-day operations of the valley's metabolism. So, of course, the human dabbling was doomed to fall short of her system. One reason that the canal version was visibly worse than the snaking beck version was because in a straight waterway, one loses any variety in topography. The curves and turns are where soil and gravel accumulate when deposited by the current, creating a variety of water features like ripples, rapids, and quiet eddies. A couple of small ponds and marshy areas were also sculpted back into the bottoms. Each of these areas promotes different sorts of aquatic and water-adjacent life, and so the Rebanks family quickly saw the return of so many signs of life that accompany a healthy stream. Frogs and their tadpoles, fish, insect life, waterfowl, and a complement of other birds attracted by the new bugs and creek life. These rewiggling, rejuvenating actions are not undertaken to secure a profit in the contemporary small economy sense of the word, because the outcome cannot be reduced to a simple cause and effect. In fact, on paper, the labor involved would register as quite the opposite of profit, but it is a sound investment nonetheless when looking at the accounts of the great economy. It is part of James's attempt to pull one foot out of the dance of modern commerce and transplant it instead where his forefathers once danced in step with the seasons and a much more ancient farming tradition, choreographed with the music of the solstice, played upon the instruments of fertility. Some of these ancestral footprints are lost, but some remain easy to discern because they have never faded. They demarcate paths that have never ceased to be used over the centuries. In the Lake District County of Cumbria, in the Valley of Matterdale, which coincides with the parish of Matterdale, into which is nestled the farm Racy Gill, the private landholdings and villages fit into the valleys like the pieces of a most picturesque jigsaw puzzle, segments often lined by stacked stone walls or hedgerows. Above these individual parcels, however, loom the lofty heights of the fells, or mountainous hills that are historically regarded as the common. Each of the 12 or so families that farm this little dale is able to access the shared communal hills above, and about 10 of the families drive their respective sheep herds up to the altitudinous peaks to spend April to October of each year thriving. By the way, drive, in this instance, means to compel forward, on foot, through the village, through ancient stone gates, and on up the fells, as opposed to the American connotation of drive, in which our sheep are loaded into Cadillac Escalades for the commute, allowing for a swing through the Starbucks drive-thru. Fascinatingly, like salmon instinctively returning upriver to their annual spawning beds, each sheep flock has over the centuries come to know its particular section of the common, which is known as being hefted to the land. The discrete flocks are amazingly able to graze and wander and cohabitate across the entire season with little to no supervision. The Herdwick breed that is James's specialty is especially suited to this rugged lifestyle, and everything about their well-being is unquestionably best served by allowing them to simply thrive in nature. To put it in more mercenary terms, Their monetary value is maximized by leaving them alone to participate in the great economy as they evolved to do. I grew up on the prairies of Illinois, known as the Prairie State, for crying out loud. So to stride across the windswept, blustery heights of the Fell with James and countenance these noble creatures made me truly feel like I was in a work of fantasy. Here was a pocket of Western civilization where the agricultural interests had not looked at the commodity of sheep and said, "Okay, this is fine, but how can we engineer more profit out of these beauties? We are humankind, so surely we can confine these critters, I mean walking up this hill here is hard, and pump them full of some industrial corn-based wonder juice or other, and leverage more wool and more meat out of them." Thankfully, the shepherds of Matterdale have not yet succumbed to the siren song of American-style bigger and better farming. But the resistance requires constant vigilance, for the wolves of capitalism are ever at the door. Standing atop this fell, commanding a breathtaking view for many miles around, I couldn't help but think of the base similarities between the Rebankses and my farming family. The qualities that had originally drawn me to the work of Wendell Berry and subsequently so many others, including Aldo Leopold and one James Rebanks. The common meats on our tables were humility and a penchant for good quality hard work. One of the most rightly venerated essays in Leopold's A Sand County Almanac is entitled The Land Ethic, in which he asserts, "I have purposely presented the land ethic as a product of social evolution, because nothing so important as an ethic is ever written. It evolved in the minds of a thinking community." There, on the fells of Matterdale, was a rich, long-established example of just such a thinking community, where lives of value were being lived, but from which nobody was getting rich. There have certainly been disagreements, and perpetual negotiations are required, as is true of any group of humans agreeing to cooperate for the good of all. But by and large, it's hard to imagine an economy like this existing for long in America. They do exist, in varied sporadic instances. Community-supported agriculture programs, CSAs, are common across the country, as well as various local co-ops and small farming collectives, reminiscent of the Burley Tobacco Program penned by John Berry Sr., father of Wendell, grandfather of Mary. Although their patriarch's legislation is no more, the Berries have, more recently, founded a beef and veal operation called Our Home Place Meat, which is based on the same Burley principles that kept a healthy small farm economy alive and well in Kentucky much longer than in other places in this country. The farms participating in the collective raise the cleanest rotation-grazed cattle that they are then able to sell at a fair price through the program. By guaranteeing a fair price to the farmers, the organization is able to ease the normal pressure they experience, participating in the boom-and-bust commodity market. Mary says, "We are making good farming pay. We are not expecting farmers to do it all, grow it, market it, deliver it, and the product is exceptional. Daddy says that we are allowing people who buy our meat to eat with a clear conscience. Our home place meat is putting something between the farmer and the marketplace to move product and set a fair price. We make a commitment to our farmers in January of every year, and then we live up to it. The farmers in our program can count on making a certain amount every year." I applaud and support their efforts, and not just because I've robustly enjoyed their exceptional rose veal. Thanks to the internet and the extravagance of modern shipping practices, I have been able to partake of the offerings of other cooperative ranch and farm outfits in Northern California, Arkansas, and Washington/Oregon. The thing that all of these movements have in common is that they're built from scratch, from the ground up, which reassures me with regard to the inexhaustible pluck of our good farming neighbors. However, it also begs the question, how can we also support farming efforts that are good for the people and the land from the top down? Can we not produce healthy meat, dairy, eggs, fruit, and produce for the whole community without needing to ship it in from Chile? This takes me back to the Civilian Conservation Corps, which I talked about in Part 1. In 1933, Leopold actually got an entire 90,000-acre watershed to agree on an experimental collaboration in league with the U.S. Soil Conservation Service and the University of Wisconsin. With the added elbow grease of CCC workers, hundreds of farmers in Coon Valley, Wisconsin, worked with scientists specializing in agriculture, forestry, and wildlife to develop agrarian methods of crop rotation, erosion protection, fertilization, strip cropping, and terracing. This revolutionary research had a profound effect on the quality of farming in the Midwest, that is, for the families that adopted the practices. Unfortunately, industrial farming motored into the scene over the next couple decades, took a brief look at the moderation required by these methods of conservation, and said decisively, "Fuck that noise." As James wrote in The Shepherd's Life, "Later I would understand that modern people the world over are obsessed with the importance of going somewhere and doing something with your life. The implication is an idea I have come to hate, that staying local and doing physical work doesn't count for much." I've said it before, but the cancer of consumerism is so insidious and pervasive that by now, in 2021, the actual act of shopping is considered a legitimate pastime. The sensibility named in James's quote is at the heart of the disregard we have developed for rural spaces, especially the vast agricultural spaces that, according to the corporate interests, are good for nothing unless you count sheep grazing. Yawn. That's so boring, counting sheep is actually a trope for how to put oneself to sleep. The effect of consumerism on us is by now that the vast majority of our population is simply unable to fathom the fidelity that James is talking about. Some of us garden, or perhaps keep bird feeders, but that is the extent of our direct communing with the great economy. And even so, we are considered the outliers. By and large, the ecological citizenship to which James and Leopold refer does not appear on the arbitrary list of choices for things with which a modern American might concern themselves. Once again, we are coddled by the false sense of security that our representation will see to it that our local resources are dispensed with everybody's best interests at heart. When Aldo Leopold wrote, "A land ethic, then, reflects the existence of an ecological conscience, and this in turn reflects a conviction of individual responsibility for the health of the land. Health is the capacity of the land for self-renewal. Conservation is our effort to understand and preserve this capacity." He was really giving us Americans a lot more credit than we have proven to be due. How often do we think about our individual responsibility for the health of the land? That term ecological conscience also kicks me right in the beanbag. I think my donkey-size awareness of this moral deficit is a big part of why I so enjoy working alongside people like my mom and dad, my aunts and uncles, and the Rebanks family. I know that I can't wrap my head around the whole complex dilemma, but they have a little bigger and better grasp than I do, so helping them has to be adding sucker in the right direction. It's a hell of a mess, our modern sense of conservation in America, thanks in no small part to the corporate interests that pay a lot of very good money to keep adding to the mess with impunity, while seducing us into looking in another direction. To my way of thinking, visionaries like Aldo Leopold have made clear for us what it'll take to maintain the health of our community, meaning the land and every one of its multitudinous citizens, including us. It comes down to our conscience, our values, a term so cheapened by modern political discourse that it's almost laughable. Where I come from, values still exist, and they're not based on skin color or religion or sexual orientation, but solely on decency. I was taught to examine my actions and see if they can be reconciled with my sense of decency when held up against it. I'm pleased to report that many, 11 times, I was in fact able to reconcile my actions at the time of this writing with what my parents taught me. Editor's note: Dutton is not accountable for any statements of moral or criminal culpability or lack thereof on the part of the author. But here in America, our Supreme Court has decided that corporations must be treated as having the same rights as individual citizens. And I wonder about that. Did the corporation's parents teach them about decency? And if so, do they hold each of their corporate actions up against that ruler of moral values to see if it is reconciled positively? Do they maintain a conviction of individual responsibility for the health of the land? How stupid are we? Part 3. Chapter 15. The Nutmeg. Parts 1 and 2 of this book were mainly focused on my 2019 trips to Glacier National Park and to my friends the Rebanks' Lake District Farm in northwestern England. Those varied and robust life chapters took place in what now seems like an innocent fairy tale, life before the COVID-19 pandemic. We thought things were rough then, and they were to an extent, as we attempted to navigate the national and global repercussions of having elected one of the most embarrassing possible humans to the highest office in America. Thanks to the unregulated channels of social media and the leering propagandists of Fox News, InfoWars, One America News Network, and their septic ilk, misinformation was at such an all-time high that we were facing millions of otherwise competent-seeming citizens holding up wet bags of shit, screaming that it was chocolate ice cream. We had climate change. We had black people being murdered by police officers. We had our usual national menu of violence against women. We had all kinds of discrimination happening. And if you're still here with me for part 3, then you know the list. All the societal evils that blossom at the bottom of the barrel in a population and fester and spread the cankers of hate and fear and greed. The qualities in humanity against which some of us strive to progress and thereby improve in the hopes that one day nobody will have to endure being systemically shat upon. Accordingly and accurately, this relative stance causes us to be labeled progressives. But it doesn't stop at that, apparently. We are also radical, socialist, communist, Marxist, leftist libtards, whom our detractors love to see cry. So that was all going on. Then the pandemic hit, officially shutting America mostly down in March of 2020. My bride Megan and I purchased some surplus toilet paper and hot sauce, which was arithmetically sound, and stayed home along with the rest of the citizenry who were lucky enough to be able to do so. We watched the news quite a bit and did our best to deal with the weird half-depression that came with the stasis of a lockdown. I was supposed to have worked on another television series and also tour more of England and several other European cities as a humorist, all canceled, obviously. As I mentioned earlier, Good hard work is the daily bread that I have come to prefer in life, mainly because I've learned that idleness is not healthy for me. In hindsight, I wish I would have had the clarity to declare, well, looks like we're sitting on our asses for several months. In that case, I am going to build a boat. Instead, Megan and I, along with most folks, had a general feeling of unease about traversing the world in any way unless absolutely necessary. We endeavored to be as cautious as possible going out for groceries, mainly more sriracha and TP, every 1 or 2 weeks, while adhering as best we could to every protocol, the science ones, not the ding-dong president's insane bleach suggestions. I smoked a lot of meat on my hasty-bake charcoal grill smoker, and Megan became obsessed with baking and cooking. I actually lost quite a bit of weight during this period. Oh, did I say weight? I meant thinness. We were doing our best to cope, along with everybody else on the planet, with the usual metabolism of our lives being so upended. In our house, good ideas generally come from Megan's quarter. Ideation is a strong skill of hers, cooking up a scheme or caper or even just a single hijink, at which point my abilities are then brought to bear, such as long-distance driving, dog wrangling, carrying luggage, and road trip cooler strategies. She gets us somewhere amazing, and I start a campfire there. At some point, a month or two into lockdown, Megan had the great idea to get some sort of RV or camping trailer, in which we might travel across the country so as to spend Thanksgiving with my family in Illinois. Like I said, she is amazing at ideas. She had heard from a friend about these nifty-as-hell new collaborations between Mercedes Sprinter vans and Airstream, which were basically like very small campers with all the engine and chassis quality of a Mercedes, but then outfitted with the deluxe fit and finish of an Airstream trailer, which sounded perfect for us. The Sprinter van has become very popular on film sets in recent years for traveling people to and fro from base camp to set, or taking a director with a handful of producers and crew out on location scouts. It has all the latest vehicular amenities, plus a ton of standing headroom. We set off for the Airstream dealership to check one out, and found a few different models nestled in the middle of a parking lot otherwise festooned with those classic aluminum Airstream trailers. They looked pretty bitchin' from the outside, but in a matter of minutes, squeezing into the back living area, we discovered that these clever rigs were just a tad snug for a couple of softening old vaudeville hoofers looking to take their ease in the autumn of their years. The vans were really impressive and tantalizing to imagine traveling and sleeping in, but just a tad claustrophobic to us. Don't get me wrong, being able to fry up a couple eggs while sitting on the can is an astonishing attribute for any living space, let alone one that gets 18 miles to the gallon, 21 highway, but perhaps it's a game best played by younger initiates than us. The day was not remotely lost, however, because the idea factory who wears my ring suggested that we just have a peek inside one of the full-size Airstreams, you know, just to check it out, even though these were clearly way too cumbersome for us to consider. We looked at a few fetching models with evocative names like the Flying Cloud, Bambi, the International, the Caravelle, and so forth, and we giggled and ogled all of the nifty built-in conveniences that have been perfected over the last several decades. Then we sat on the groovy bench-slash-couch in the lounge of one model as the breeze blew through the screened windows, carrying upon it visions of redwood forests and crashing surf, the highways of America, Roger Miller's King of the Road on the radio, and I mean, what can I say? We left having purchased a brand new 30-foot Globetrotter, unexpectedly excited in anticipation of our unforeseen new lives as streamers. I wish that I had been able to be of more service at this juncture to my partner, but Unfortunately for her efforts, I had a book to be working on, this very one, Trippy. This left Megan on her own to research and select locations at which to stay overnight on our trip, a somewhat frustrating endeavor. Normally, I take pride in being a comfort to my wife and pitching in with both shoulders when she asks me to lend her assistance of any type. So I was acutely pained to be unavailable and a useless deadbeat to her as I immersed myself in writing about George Saunders and Jeff Tweedy and such. As I was to later realize, she was able to learn a great deal about locations called RV parks, establishments that were specifically outfitted to accommodate rigs like our Globetrotter. Megan set straight to work outfitting the Nutmeg of Consolation, as we called her, employing her usual aplomb for interior design, meaning rugs and throw pillows and linens. I mean, friends, when she puts sheets and also the sheety-like bags that go over the pillows on a bed, it feels so amazing to slide into that I often laugh out loud with pleasure. Not that we had actually gotten to the outfitting yet. We have no place to park a 30-foot trailer at our home, so I intended to retrieve her from the dealer about a week before our departure and roll the dice parking her on the street. Until then, my bride took over the garage floor with a dazzling array of fabrics, cookware, utensils, and just good flavor. Like literally, as in jars and bags of spices and grocery items for the galley. It looked amazing, like some kind of vision board from one of those fancy design magazines, except with even cooler choices. I'm not exaggerating when I say she's out of my league. If anything, she owns my league, and I'm just in to pinch hit off the bench, getting the signal to bunt. The day finally arrived for me to bring the Nutmeg home from the Airstream spawning grounds, and so that I could comfortably haul our new 4-ton baby, I had traded in my sensible Audi Q5 for a much brawnier Ford Expedition, V6, 400 horsepower. As a kid in Illinois, I had been trained to operate the necessary trucks and tractors so that I could be called upon to haul another wagon out to the field in case all the actual able hands were unavailable. I had also hauled trailers working on a construction crew as a teenager, which means that I could maneuver a trailer forward and unforward after I'd had a couple beers, because this was in the 80s when one was required to drink a beer before getting behind the wheel of a work truck. This is all to say that I knew my way around the peculiarities of hauling a trailer. So long as you pay attention and make nice wide turns, driving it down the road is not a huge deal. You quickly realize that you have to drive modestly. And the fact that the 8-foot-wide vehicle combination appears to take up the entire lane from dotted line to dotted line? Well, I believe that is the problem of the other drivers. I live on a cul-de-sac. And I knew that was going to be a problem, even during the short time we'd have the Nutmeg at our home. First, would I be able to turn my rig around, with 20 feet of Ford and 30 feet of Airstream behind me? That adds up to somewhere between 40 and 60 feet. Then, presuming I could get it turned around to head back out the way I came in, how in the wide, wide world of sports was I going to decently back an 8-foot by 30-foot rectangle into the side of a circular cul-de-sac? I guess before I go on any further, I had better introduce you to Adam. Adam and his wife Sandy are a type of neighbor that we often refer to as Norman Rockwellian. They would make great horror characters because they are so terrific and nice and supportive